Good evening, everyone. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here and to be able to address an audience of this kind. So many thanks to Carol for inviting all four of us. I'm a little bit undecided whether to introduce the speakers first or just say my bit about biography first. Perhaps I'll do the biography first and then segue into a little bit about each speaker and then we'll start with the talks. Biography is a word, of course, that has broad application. On the one hand, it can apply to the two or three scholarly tome, the life in three volumes, two or three volumes. On the other hand, it can be a breezy sort of introduction to a celebrity. And we use the same word of both, of the full spectrum of things that means biography. But I think we're talking about it this evening in a fairly serious sense. These are all very professional people on my right. And I think the first thing I'd say is that writing biography is pleasurable, yes, but it's also problematic and it can be perilous. I'm not going to go into stories tonight of libel action, but I would like to say there are very serious reasons why you need to be brave to write biography. It's not just the labour involved, about which we may hear later on, nor the obsessive research involving more travel and hours of work that can ever be deemed cost-effective. Biography also requires a self-exposing judiciousness. At every stage in the procedure, decisions have to be made, and they're usually made alone, perhaps in consultation with somebody else, but often you're very much left on your own as to decide, and often decide quite quickly what is the fact you want or you don't want, and what action you should take with regard to material or people or visits or whatever. So you have no committee, no line manager to keep you in the right place. And I think the rightness or wrongness of those decisions affect not only the selection and use of the material, but almost every aspect of the project, from the initial negotiations with any descendants there may be of your subject or a literary executor, and so on. And I think few of us biographers get by without erring at some point. You'll probably already know that biographies are very easily distorted by flattery or idealization. They can also be dulled by a superfluity of facts. And I must confess that when I wrote one of my early biographies of Vanessa Bell, sister of Virginia Woolf, I included a letter which even mentioned a forgotten sponge bag. And one reviewer pointed out that this was one thing too much. And for a while afterwards, when critics wanted to say that a biography was overstuffed, they would refer to it as a sponge bag. School of biographies. I still to say I feel so deeply ashamed of being the source of this information. I can hardly bear to take one with me when I travel. But before touching on other perils, let me first acknowledge that there is a certain anxiety, I think, that sometimes accompanies the mere admission, maybe some of you will have found this, of admitting publicly that you are engaged in writing a biography. And there's a long history of invective against it. "May God blast anyone who writes a biography of me," wrote J.M. Barrie. Famously, George Eliot declared that biographers are generally a disease of English literature. And this despite the fact that she lived happily with Goethe's biographer, G.H. Lewes. Germaine Greer caught public attention when she dismissed biographies as predigested carrion. And one often hears remarks that seem to imply that biographies serve our worst selves, appealing to our prurience, our weakness, or our snobbery. Some people even think they encourage us to behave badly. But there's a whole set of things one can put in opposition to this. The poet of the present-day journalist and memoirist Jeremy Lewis, for many years, he's quite a significant figure on the literary scene, said that he hated reading biographies. He thought them inherently second-rate and second-hand, and he claimed to have no desire at all to write such wretched things. And then he was cajoled into writing a biography of Cyril Connolly, and his attitude changed. He suddenly became rather proud of this genre, arguing it attempts, after all, the resurrection of the dead, and what could be more miraculous than that? Of course, there is much more to be said on the positive side of the labour involved in writing biography and what biographies do. They are a crucial vehicle, of course, of communication across generations of memory, history, human values and behaviour. It also offers often, in many cases, a way in into a person's intellectual or creative life, and often this sometimes has to be done by remembering to deal with grossly material things. Here, listen to Virginia Woolf in this passage. Imaginative work is not dropped like a pebble upon the ground, as science may be. It is like a spider's web, attached to life at all four corners. When the web is pulled askew, hooked up at the edge, torn in the middle, one remembers that these webs are not spun in midair by incorporeal creatures, but are the work of suffering human beings, and are attached to grossly material things, like health and money and the houses we live in. Just a tiny bit more. Dr. Johnson felt that biography made good what is missing in history. The general and rapid narratives of history, Johnson wrote, which involve 1,000 fortunes in the business of the day, afford few lessons applicable to private life. And Michael Holroyd has used that quote to argue that biography can actually humanize history. But I think even more important is another assertion that comes from Johnson. He once said, "No species of writing seems more worthy of cultivation than biography." This is in 1750 in the Rambler. "Since none can be more delightful or more useful. I have often thought that there has rarely passed a life of which a judicious and faithful narrative would not be useful." So I think that emphasis on judicious and faithful is something we might keep in mind, because certainly, as we will hear this evening, biographers have to face up to responsibilities. Responsibilities to facts, to ethical issues, to historical accuracy, and therefore to the past, but also to the future, to one's audience, and above all, to one's craft. And so a lot of things come into action when you try actually to put a biography together. Sometimes even a tiny short phrase in a letter can betray much characteristic ways of looking at things, for instance. And I wrote about Vanessa Bell, who is a Stoic, and I discovered in the letter that she admitted feeling agitation. You might think that's a fairly mild word. We get agitated if we miss a bus or whatever. But for her, I knew that that meant something was seriously wrong. So you have to get inside the register of even their vocabulary, as well as much as you can into their way of thinking. Many people who you try to write about may want to resist it. I wrote a biography of the poet Stevie Smith, and at a fairly late stage in the work, I heard that the British Council in London had, in the late 1960s, produced LPs of poets reading their own work. And they kept a file of biographical details that they'd asked for, presumably to put on the back of the LP or something. And I went along to the British Council eager to see what facts Stevie Smith had supplied about herself. And I was put, a fat file was put in front of me. And of course I learnt looking through it what a lot of, what active lives poets have, what a lot of prizes they win, how busy they are, how many residences they fill, how many wives they have, and how extensively they travel. And finally I got to Stevie Smith. I should have looked at S right at the bottom, shouldn't I, first? And it amounted to merely two typewritten sentences. This is all she thought was necessary. "Born in Howell, full stop, but moved to London at the age of 3 and has lived in the same house ever since." Why struggle with biography? Flights into anonymity. But we're living in an interesting period, and it's certainly for our biographer perhaps more difficult nowadays, post-structuralist and deconstructive theorists have questioned the whole notion of the individual as an originating point of consciousness and sought to disconnect the life from the work. It's rather a delicious feeling, I think, that the fame of, delicious irony, that the fame of Roland Barthes' essay, The Death of the Author, is today a major reason why his name lives on. And yet, there are many questions that we, in the 21st century, might want to ask a biography. How does a biographer combine factual accuracy with innovation? Must a strong narrative drive be at the expense of contingencies? What kinds of selfhood are on display in the presentation of identity? And how do we reconcile the private individual with the performative nature of public life? Should biographers imitate Boswell and promise veracity about themselves as well as their subjects? What is our responsibility to a past which in some ways remains open, not completed, while we write in the present and for the future? And is there a place in biography for postmodernist indeterminacy? And what is the role that psychoanalysis has played in our understanding of the practice of biography? How has it deepened awareness of the difficulties and the questions one might ask? I think that's some, we've arrived at what we're hoping to hear something about tonight. So, if I may just give a brief welcome to our speakers. The first person who is going to speak is Marion Bauer. And she is herself a registered adult psychotherapist. And she's also worked as a consultant social worker at the Tavistock Clinic. And she's very interestingly writing a biography of one of Freud's own patients and his favourite translator. Then we move on to Dee McQuillan, who is a voluntary mental worker, a social health, mental health worker, and she's writing a PhD under the psychoanalysis unit at University College. And she is working on James Strachey, who translated the standard works of Freud, and his translation sat on the shelves of psychoanalysts for decades, didn't they, until a recent, more recent translation came along. And so that will be extremely interesting because his brother became a famous biographer, James Strachey's brother. And then finally we have Emma Letley, who's written a biography on Marion Milner, who lived very near by in this part of London, and who is a psychoanalytic psychotherapist. So I think we've got a lot of good things to hear. May I hand over now to Marion.
Can you hear me? Yes, I can hear me too. Rather strange experience. Sorry, I just got to put on my reading glasses. The title of this presentation is She Despises All the Rest of Us, Especially the Women. As you can see from the title, Joan Rivière could be a difficult woman. Her sarcasm was legendary. In fact, one of her my favourite of her sarcastic remarks was, socialism, that religion of younger siblings. Jeremy Corbyn, eat your heart out. And her first analyst, Ernest Jones, described her as a fiendish sadist. I found this invigorating, yet it was not the whole story. In her archive, there were kind and supportive letters to former patients, who often sounded rather tiresome, I have to say, but obviously the patients had been pleased enough with her letters to keep them. The biggest problem, however, with her was to find the private Joan. Her diary contains only one-line entries, which hint at a turbulent life beneath the surface. Paradoxically, her inner life was laid bare in a series of dazzling papers where she is the patient, in inverted commas. This gives an unusual life to the papers, but her ordinary feelings are harder to come by. Like James Strachey, who was her friend and rival, and I just want to say that he actually translated quite a lot of Freud too. She translated quite a lot of Freud too, so it wasn't only him. Joan was an unlikely psychoanalyst. This presentation is a series of snapshots of the people and experiences which led her to that rather unlikely outcome. On February the 12th, 1916, a tall, beautiful, married woman in her early 30s went to the library of the Society for Psychical Research and took out books by Sigmund Freud and Ernest Jones. Joan Rivière had been suffering from depressions since the birth of her daughter in 1908. No treatment seemed to help. There were bromides, bed rest, and more recently trips to sanatoriums. depressions could be frightening, and at one point she was looked after by a mental nurse while her daughter had another nurse. After a meeting in Dr. Jones' consulting rooms, they agreed to start psychoanalysis straight away. It was a terrible mistake. What Riviere did not know was that Ernest Jones had a history of boundary violations, which were gross, even by the lax standards of the time. Following accusations that he had molested children in a special school, he hastily moved to Canada with his mistress, Loie Kahn. In Canada, a woman accused him of making sexual advances and hired a protector with a gun. Things were now too hot in Canada, and unabashed, he returned to England and set up as a psychoanalyst. Nowadays, of course, it's all much more carefully regulated. With Riviere, his boundary problem took another form. In fact, it was actually quite well meant. When she complained of nowhere to go for holiday, it was, after all, the First World War, but she hardly noticed this, Jones lent her his holiday cottage, not once, but twice. Not surprisingly, she got the wrong idea and was soon declaring her love for him. Jones's response was unusual. Recognizing her considerable intelligence, he decided she would make a good psychoanalyst and started to refer patients to her. Riviere accepted the referrals, in fact there were five, but unleashed a torrent of reproachful letters to Jones, including threats of suicide. It's hard to believe, but during this period, Jones carried on analysing patients, listening to Jones's difficulties with his new marriage, and looking after his dog when he went to Switzerland. However, a new note crept into her letters, the importance of psychoanalysis in her life. By 1920, she was a member of the newly constituted British Psychoanalytic Society. She had a career. The psychoanalyst in Joan recognized that she had not been entirely fully analyzed. In 1920, she had translated a short but important paper by Freud for the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. This gave her confidence to write in 1921, asking Freud if he would take her on as a patient. Freud, a fluent English speaker, had liked Jones' translation. He wrote to Riviere that as his translator and a senior member of the British Society, she would take precedence over other patients, and he would see her early in 1922, which he did. Jones was dismayed. Freud would not only be analysing Riviere, but also his mistakes. He decided to get his retaliation in first. He wrote to Freud, "I am specially interested in the case, for it is the worst failure I ever had. I underestimated the uncontrollability of her emotions." And then he goes on that Joan was furious with him and tormented him cruelly. Finally, Joan softened towards her. "I think she understands psychoanalysis better than any other member of the British Society. Incidentally, she has a strong complex about being a well-born lady, county family, and despises all the rest of us, especially the women." This is the Joan Riviere I love. Brilliant, passionate, snobbish, cruel. But for me, it raised the question of how a well-born lady came to be Freud's favourite translator, the psychoanalyst of John Bowlby, Donald Winnicott, and Susan Isaacs. Talent is part of the answer, but Riviere's background was not as conventional as Jones implied. She was born in 1883. Her father, Hugh Verrill, was a solicitor in Brighton. Her mother, Anna, was the daughter of a vicar. Anna took refuge from her 12 siblings by going as a governess to Malta. And in fact, she stayed there 7 years, so it must have been pretty dreadful at home. Somehow, Anna and Hugh met and married. Hugh's health was delicate, especially when Anna had a baby. And Anna ruthlessly put his needs first. They went on long trips abroad, even when the three children were quite small. Anna, of course, is the bad guy in most accounts of Joan's childhood, but she was a highly competent woman and loved beauty with a passion, qualities that Joan inherited from her. When Joan was born, Anna quickly noticed that she was a very sensitive child. Unfortunately, this was not something that Anna could respond to. Luckily for Joan, her uncle Arthur Verrill and his wife Margaret provided the warmth and responsiveness she craved. And, as we shall see, they influenced her life in unexpected ways. Arthur was a shareholder in a new progressive boarding school for girls called Wickham Abbey, which still exists, full of girls. When Joan was 15, Arthur persuaded her parents to send her there. The school offered the same subjects as a boys' school, and it's likely that Joan started to learn German there. Although Joan learned useful subjects such as carpentry, the emotional life of the school was restricted. Miss Dove, the head, was a brilliant businesswoman, but did not want the girls to hear music which stirred up their feelings. In fact, emotions altogether were rather banned. There is a photograph of Joan with a small group of girls standing at the very edge of the group and looking very strained. This is a position which she often took up in life. Although she was a brilliant expositor of Klein's work, she was unhappy to be part of the Kleinian group. After the breakdown of Wickham Abbey, it was a depressive breakdown that happened, Anna took Joan out of the school and picked a fight with the headmistress. But she made two decisions, this is Anna, for Joan, which on the surface seemed unhelpful, but later turned out to be crucial for Joan's development. Firstly, she sent Joan to Gotha in Germany for a year. Imagine a depressed 16-year-old being sent away for a year. Anyway, but usefully, she would learn German and continue with her music and art. Sending young people to be finished in Germany was common practice at the time. In fact, my husband's grandmother, Mary Solomon, was sent to Hanover in 1913 and found herself strewing flowers in front of the Kaiser. Apparently he was particularly fond of cornflowers. And then in 1914, of course, she had to be hastily recalled. Joan developed a crush on an older man in Gotha, but returned home with fluent German, ready to be launched on the marriage market. However, despite her popularity at Hunt Balls, she was moody and cold with her family, not surprisingly, as she'd been away for a year. But for some reason, Anna and Hugh decided not to send Joan to Newnham, where Margaret Verrill, her aunt, was a lecturer in classics. Instead, they apprenticed Joan to a famous dressmaker, Mrs. Nettleship. At first sight, this seems a wildly unsuitable idea for a highly intelligent, intellectual girl. However, Mrs. Nettleship was no ordinary dressmaker. She was the dressmaker for Ellen Terry, Henry Irving, Mrs. Oscar Wilde. Her dresses expressed the wearer's personality. When Ellen Terry played Lady Macbeth, Mrs. Nettleship made her a dress out of thousands of glittering beetle wings. It's actually painted by Sargent, and it's in the Tate Gallery if you want to see it. Joan loved dressmaking. It's mentioned repeatedly in her diary. In fact, it's mentioned far more often than her husband. After she was married, she rented rooms, moved in furniture, and set herself up as a dressmaker. This was her first attempt at a career. The venture quickly looked like it was going to be a success. Joan had customers and had fittings scheduled in her diary. Then she collapsed with what seemed a physical illness. 23 years later, Joan was to turn this experience into a dazzling and original psychoanalytic paper. She took Freud's title, Those Wrecked by Success. Even after her marriage, Joan made frequent visits to Arthur and Margaret Verrill. both were lecturers and classics at Cambridge with unconventional views on their subjects. James Strachey, I think this is a man's view, thought it was Arthur Verrill who influenced Joan with his ability to cut through Kant. Myself, taking the female view, I think that the significant influence on Joan was Margaret and her close friend Jane Harrison. Harrison founded the Myth and Ritual School. The key assumption was, to paraphrase Mary Beard, that under the smooth marble surface of classical antiquity lay seething forces expressed through religion. The friendly collaboration between Jane and Margaret was a model for Joan of two professional women working together. But Margaret had another, possibly more compelling interest. The Society for Psychical Research, which still exists, actually, shares its premises with a funeral parlour. This was the intellectual wing of spiritualism. Its aim was to provide rigorous research into psychic phenomena. Frederick Myers, another Cambridge man, one of the founders of the SPR, quickly cottoned on to the work of Freud and Breuer on hysteria. It was proof that parts of the mind existed which were hitherto unknown. They were hoping that those parts would communicate with other worlds. Freud was co-opted for the SPR and wrote a paper on the unconscious for the SPR's proceedings in 1912. It's absolutely inevitable that Joan would have read this paper. By the time Joan took out books by Freud from the SPR library, more of Freud's work was available, translated into execrable English by A.A. Brill. Joan could not bear to see anything done badly, and this may have been the seeds of her career as Freud's translator. Although Joan only saw Freud for 6 months, they formed a very high view of each other. With brilliant acumen, Freud identified one of Joan's key difficulties. It's rather confusing. I say he wrote to Jones, Ernest Jones. She cannot tolerate praise, triumph, or success, not any better than blame or repudiation. We see this quite often in rock stars who kill themselves at the height of their fame, but it is a phenomenon that's quite common. Freud carried on, "You know what that means. It's an infallible sign of a deep sense of guilt, of a conflict between ego and ideal." Freud enabled Joan to accept his present of translations editor of the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. In due course, he asked her to translate The Ego and the Id, a very key paper in his work. And he expected that she would understand, from a personal point of view, some of the things it said. There are probably quite a lot of things that could be said about translators, but that's not my topic. When Joan returned to England, her psychoanalytic colleagues found her much easier to get along with, but she still felt on the edge of things as she had at school. All this changed in 1922, when she went to a psychoanalytic congress in Berlin. While there, she met Melanie Klein. Before long, Klein and Joan were holidaying with Joan's husband, Evelyn, in Switzerland. At first sight, they were an unlikely couple. Klein was a pioneer of child analysis, and Joan didn't like children. But what they shared was a devotion to a rigorous analytic approach. They also both loved clothes. There's a photograph from around this time of Klein wearing beach pyjamas and a floppy hat, and Joan also wearing a floppy hat and wearing a very fashionable drop-waisted dress. They both looked delighted with themselves. Not long after this, Joan's loyalty to Klein was tested. Anna Freud was working with children using a mixture of analytic and educational approaches. She wrote a book which contained a direct attack on Klein's approach, which, of course, was more rigorous. By now, Klein was living in England, and Ernest Jones quickly organised a seminar on child analysis. Joan contributed a paper which successfully demolished Anna Freud's critique of Klein. These papers were published in the International Journal. Freud was furious and fired off a letter to Joan. What he didn't say, and which actually at the time I don't think many people knew, was Anna was his psychoanalytic patient. He was too fond of Riviere to be angry with her for long, and despite a furious letter, it ends, "I greet you warmly." You may be wondering, just to pick up an earlier theme, how dressmaking contributed to all this. Firstly, having a dress made is a very intimate activity. Anyone here old enough to remember having a dress made, as I am, will know this. It leads to confidences from the customer, and sometimes from the dressmaker, I found, which one has to keep. It's also a business. As Riviere put it, I'm quoting Riviere now, "Among the analyst's motives, his need to make a livelihood plays a part." She had in mind, when she wrote that, Donald Winnicott. When he started his analysis with Joan, he misled her about his finances, so she charged him half her usual fee. When she found out that he was financially considerably better off than he had implied, she wrote him a kind but firm letter about the need for analyst and patient to cooperate on money matters as part of the analytic structure. It's very interesting, actually, if you read Winnicott's biographer's accounts, Brett Carr omits it entirely, I think, and says that Riviere was horrid to Winnicott. A chap called Rodman, who's an American biographer of Winnicott, goes into it in some detail, perhaps not having any vested interests.
Now you're coming close to
your... I've got one paragraph, is that right? And did she despise the women? She had no tolerance of fools, regardless of gender, but she loved her Aunt Margaret, her cousin Helen, and Jane Harrison. She loved Klein for her intuition and her brilliance, although sometimes Joan's ideas were ahead of Klein's. As well as a friendship, I think the relationship with Klein was a therapeutic one. They fell out in old age, but Joan left the Melanie Klein Trust the residue of her estate in her will. The Melanie Klein Trust initiated a book of Riviere's papers, which is where I first encountered her. Fortunately, I don't know if she would despise me, but I know what I think of her. I think the idea, as far as ideas go, she was a unique personality whose psychoanalytic ideas are still being used today, very often without acknowledgement.
Hello. Well, I'm taking a slightly different tack. We'll sort of see how much I run on for, because I haven't actually given you a lot of specific biographical detail about the man I'm studying, James Strachey, because I got rather exercised by the question of the nature of the relationship between psychoanalysis and biography. So I'll just sort of start with what I've got and see, you know, perhaps I can tell you a bit more about him and his background. And Marion's come up with a lot of points on which the two people are interrelated. They had a lot of acquaintances in common and background in common. So I wanted to start by saying I really think it's a very, very nice point that biography, which is often sort of defamed and belittled as the illegitimate child of history and literature, is actually the senior partner here. And that, you know, it sort of reminds me, thinking about Johnson, etc., how recent psychoanalysis actually is. Now, on the question of whether they are unnatural bedfellows, I believe there's certainly a grounds for saying that they are at times pretty darn uncomfortable together, I'm afraid. And it's the case that there are disputed territories between biography and psychoanalysis. So I'm going to start by telling you a brief little bit about my project, which I'm doing at UCL. I'm currently doing doctoral research into Strachey's working life from approximately 1908 to 1908 to 1945. I was about to say 1845 and take him backwards. That's to say I'm working on his life between Cambridge University, he was at Trinity College, and the beginnings of two projects to publish a complete works of Sigmund Freud, and I do say that advisedly. These were both projects to do a complete Freud that failed. The standard edition really didn't get going till some period after 1948. James Strachey was analysed by Freud in Vienna, I guess in the couch, you know, that we're sitting above, from October 1920 until June 1922. And later he had come back to this particular house because I know that he went to see Freud a couple of times when Freud was here and obviously gravely ill. I've bracketed out any major focus on the quality of the Strachey's translations, as my German is really pretty terrible. It's nicht good. But I'm able to make some contributions on the basis of my research on the question of how much Strachey knew about the German language before he became involved officially with his first translation in 1921. And I've also got some interesting new facts about how motivated he was regarding translation, because the work I'm doing is drawing very heavily on a huge archive at the British Library. I don't know if anyone knows it, but the Strachey papers there are like about 65 huge bound volumes and 140 loose folders sent there first by Alex Strachey and Michael Holroyd, and then Michael Holroyd's deposited more papers. So it goes on and on. It's a huge amount of primary documentation, and from this, you know, you can pick out things like Strachey was trying to work, he was in Moscow in 1914 before the war, and he was interested in translating. He was teaching himself and being instructed in Russian first, and also I've managed to unearth a letter in which he approaches Jones about translating a book by a woman called Hug Helmuth, who some of you will probably know here, called The Tug Book, the Diary of a Maiden, a Young Girl. I've got something to contribute, but certainly not my German skills. From this work, I'm hoping to write a biography, which situates me in a line of biographers, and it's really, as Francis knows, a very scary line of biographers, because James Strachey's brother was Lytton Strachey, who was, you know, much more famous in their own lifetimes than James. He was deliberately iconoclastic and succinct biographer of such Victorian idols as Florence Nightingale, General Gordon, and Queen Victoria herself. He wrote Elizabeth and Essex, which is questionably his most strongly psychoanalytically influenced biography. James Strachey was always his brother's editor of choice. He worked through everything that Lytton did before it was sent off to be edited by a publisher. James Strachey had worked for a while at The Spectator, which had given him a very good basis in proofreading, rewriting, fact-checking. He hated The Spectator. The Spectator was owned by a cousin of his, but James Strachey was always, from as soon as he begins to express political opinions, always left-wing, and he says that one of the things that Joan Rivière regretted about him was his sort of leftish tendencies. But, yeah, The Spectator gave him a really good grounding in how to put a magazine or a book together. So he worked on Lytton's biographical work, and later he worked very closely, but as far as he was concerned, with kind of very little satisfaction, on Ernest Jones' Freud biography. Jones would write him letters checking facts, and then to Strachey's indignation, Jones would not put his corrections in, or he'd make a further mistake. Apparently there was once a copy of the Jones biography which had all Strachey's corrections, his own and other people's own, but I haven't been able to track that down yet. In the 1960s, James Strachey accepted Michael Holroyd's offer to write a biography of Lytton, and the two of them worked on this for several years at the same time when Strachey was really working flat out to finish his standard edition. He was an old man by then. He was born, I should tell you, in 1887 and lived to 1967. He came from a long-lived family, but he was struggling towards the end because he was probably overworking for an 80-year-old. So he and Michael Holroyd got together over these hundreds of letters. There was an outhouse in Alex's rather nice house in Buckinghamshire, which was stuffed full of all the letters that James and Lytton had collected all over during their lifetimes. When James Strachey was in doubt or disagreement, I've missed a bit. Strachey always waited on, in a rather psychoanalytic method perhaps, he always waited for Michael Holroyd to come to him and tell him what he was making of Lytton Strachey's lives. and they discussed. And when they disagreed, James's doubts and disagreements went into proper footnotes at the bottom of the page that they were related to, not like horrible modern footnotes, you know, which are shoved to the end so no one reads. So they sort of jump out at you, and some of them are marvellously funny and some of them are very acid. But however, there's a kind of impression, talking a bit about this, say, the historiography of Strachey and Holroyd's work, that their differences were great, whereas actually, Strachey gave Holroyd unlimited access to all the letters that he had, which, you know, were hundreds of them, some of them very confidential, I guess. And I believe that Michael Holroyd was also his literary executive with Alex. And when James Strachey died, Alex, his wife, read the biography, saying that James Strachey had a very soft spot in his heart for him. Now, one deduction I make from these several strands of biographical interest running through Strachey's life is that Strachey is an example of one psychoanalyst, at least, who thought that biography, as in a proper biography by non-psychoanalytic people, was a worthwhile endeavour. Indeed, in Holroyd's view, Strachey had a didactic or tendacious hope that the biography of Lytton would show him as a man who, had he lived longer, would have campaigned for equal rights for homosexuals. Strachey believed very strongly that something in his brother's life had been strangulated by the fact that he was gay and was not able to, you know, make that public. Of course, it was well known to his little close set of Bloomsbury friends. The plan from here on is I'm going to attempt to make some, if I've got time, some general remarks on common ground and points of difference between biography and psychoanalysis, which I've become aware of during my work in Strachey. They'll be my own remarks, and they're unlikely to be original. But there are sort of three fault lines or tensions between biography and psychoanalysis that are important to me. So these are my points of departure. Before that, I want to say it's useful to make a distinction, which we did at the start, between psychoanalysis, the therapeutic practice, and psychoanalysis as applied to biography or literature or history studies. And I'm very much looking in this case at psychoanalysis, the practice, because it was one of James Strachey's specialities. He wrote very few papers on his own right, but he did write extensively on psychoanalytic technique and how psychoanalysis might work. And he also gave training seminars at the Institute. So, my three points really are confidentiality. Biographies have been censored, of course, and suppressed because of concerns under this heading. But a biographer's aim really is to be published and be read. Now, in psychoanalytical therapy, by contrast, in everything the analysand says, it should be confidential. And we might discuss that later, because Marion's giving examples of the times when there was a great deal of leakage, say, between Freud and Jones. But things have changed, and say, from the 1950s to 1960s, we expect psychoanalytic confidentiality to be sort of absolute. The second point of difference is the psychoanalytic situation. I mean, maybe I'm saying something obvious. I mean, I think as a generalisation, all biographers would long to be able to get their subject on the couch and in the sense of longing to be able to understand and describe something of their unconscious mind, unless we're talking about a biographer who totally denies the existence of unconscious processes. And I myself have searched high and low for accounts of dreams of Strachey's or for clinical examples of his that might be his material, thinly disguised, you know, sort of notorious thing that Freud does. And John Forrester also comes up with a beautiful example of Alex Strachey, James's wife, doing that. But I've had no success. And having said this, I believe that in reality the circumstances of therapeutic psychoanalysis and those of biographical work very rarely can withstand close comparison. Maybe Francis will answer me on that. The third point is really obvious but very important. It's language, really. Psychoanalysis has its own language, and it reminds me of that, you know, that group we all love, those admirable, careful users of readers who write to the papers or criticise M&S over saying less rather than fewer. And there is a tendency, certainly in the past there has been a tendency among psychoanalysts, which inclines them to criticise biographers for appropriating their terms and misusing them and, you know, mangling the riches of psychoanalysis. So those are my points of divergence. Now, on the subject of confidentiality, I wanted to offer you the following information, which to me gives a kind of interesting context on psychoanalysis' early incursions into the territory of biography. I found this in the Freud-Jung letters. In 1909, Freud and Jung had founded the Jahrbuch for psychoanalytical and psychopathological research. which was going to be a new important journal and going to attract a load of medical and intellectual people all over Europe to take an interest in psychoanalysis. Freud had already spoken about the Ratman to his Viennese colleagues on the Wednesday meetings, and he'd also discussed it at Salzburg in 1908, and Jung is trying to get Freud to undertake to write it up. And in November 1908, Freud tells Jung that it is likely that an inner distaste for indiscretion prevents me from writing my other contribution, The Rat Man with the Obsessional Neurosis. Well, in the event, Jung eventually does get this case history, but Freud's concerns about confidentiality, which continue in this period, I find worth noting. In 1908, Jung describes his own interest in mythology and asks Freud, won't you cast a beam of light in that direction as a kind of spectrum analysis par distance? And Freud then replies that they must conquer not only the whole field of mythology. He goes on to say we must also take hold of biography, and that the riddle of Leonardo da Vinci's character would be a first step in the realm of biography. And of course, we probably all know, you're probably interested in, you've probably all read a lot of Freud. He goes on to write this in the first place. That appears in Jahrbuch. Now, it kind of seems to me that these events and concerns could be related. There is a context of pressure to find papers for and case histories for this new journal of theirs, and there's a conflict between the pressure of expansion and an awareness of considerations of confidentiality. So I would argue perhaps that something of Freud's impulse to take hold of biography may have originated in seeing biography as a potential source of clinical material that could be analysed without reservations over patients' confidentiality. I mean, I'm sure other people have said this, but it really leapt out at me. And this mode of applying psychoanalysis, because this is psychoanalysts applying psychoanalysis, seems to me to differ to some degree from applications of theory to create a critique, in that they're turning to biography to generate case histories and biographies in a search for clinical examples. So I think I'd better go. I'm running out of time. How much have I got left? Oh, right. Okay. Well, I'd better really go fast forward. I'm so sorry. On the question of language, I was going to say that they're very, very unhappy bedfellows indeed. And I was going to give you some examples. I mean, perhaps I can do a little bit later. Have I got 5 minutes? Oh, right. Okay. So I wanted to return to my work and give you an example of how I might describe in two different registers James Strachey's psychoanalysis with Freud on the subject of his sexuality. Some of the information you need for this, if you don't know it already, is that Strachey was born at the tail end of a huge Victorian family. There were 9 siblings who survived in him. He was born when his father was 70, and that most biographic commentators think that his energetic mother, who was much younger, was the dominant force. His siblings ranged in seniority from 3 to 28 years older than him, and that his brother Lytton was gay. Writing in a normal register, rather than a psychoanalytical one, I would avoid saying that Strachey seems to have identified with his brother Lytton. Instead, I would say that James Strachey adopted or imitated his brother Lytton's sexuality up until approximately 1916. And one effect of this was that when Strachey goes to see Freud, that Freud's probably found himself analysing 2 homosexual complexes. Now, on the other hand, attempting to write psychoanalytically, I've written that Strachey's adult sexuality appeared to be based on identification with Lytton Strachey. I've used the word advisedly, meaning to assimilate an aspect of another which becomes a part of the personality. And I've got a great deal of proof to substantiate my assertions about the nature of James and Lytton's relationship and the element of mirroring and the referring to homosexuality as we. Trying to write psychoanalytically again, I've censored my own thought about there being 2 Strachey Oedipus complexes. I would only say that to a non-psychoanalytic context, because I suspect that to an experienced analyst, any Oedipus complex will inevitably be a shadow of someone else's. So I'm, as to a psychoanalyst, I'm stating the obvious. And I've also, trying to stay within psychoanalytic bounds, I delete my own remark, which is it seems totally bizarre to me that Strachey, with 3 significantly elder brothers, should identify with a brother only 7.5 years older than him. But I can just anticipate the answer to that, which, you know, perhaps a lot of us know, which is going to be something along the lines of, we're talking about the unconscious here, the operation of primary processes. You know, there is no logic. So this is just a question of how I'm having to accommodate myself to the constraints. Can I say one thing more briefly? Yep. I went, this was slightly horrific, to prepare for this evening, I went to the British Library to look at the Holroyd Strachey correspondence concerning the Lytton Strachey biography. And I actually had a disturbing find. I managed to confirm that I was right, that that James Strachey often tolerated Michael Holroyd's attempts to make sense of his brother psychologically. So in that way, you know, Strachey seemed to be able to reach some sort of tolerance of abnormal common sense psychology. But what I found is that Alex Strachey had gone through the manuscript of the famous Holroyd Lytton Strachey biography and left pages of notes, and I'm just going to end on some of these. This is the start. Sentimentality, the deplorable result of repressed knowledge. These were comments about Holroyd's coverage of Lytton Strachey's childhood, which unfortunately I can't quite cite for you because they were based on a typescript, which I haven't got. So, and then next thing, Alex Strachey says, how does H know that this is an extension of self-dislike, amateur psychoanalysis? This criticism should be substantiated by examples. Is this really justified, that Lytton's veneration for his dad in childhood caused him to be subservient to his own love objects? Amateur psychoanalysis and psychosomaticism, and so on and so forth. This went on and on. And I feel that I would fare far worse. You know, I would be if I was at the mercy of Alex Strachey. And I very much admire Michael Holroyd for adding her comments to the Strachey papers. So there they are. We can all have a look at them. I don't believe he saw them till after her death. But to me, these sort of comments serve to illustrate and perhaps warn of some of the difficulties biographers may encounter if and when they try to get into bed with psychoanalysis. Thank you.
I'm going to try without a microphone because I find it too difficult to manipulate the handheld microphone and look at my notes. If you can't hear me, please tell me. How is it at the moment? Is it okay? Okay. Now, I'm going to put the microphone down for a moment. I've called this the unincluded or the unsaid in the book I wrote about Marion Milner. As a note, I should say, it's now 2 years since the biography of Marion Milner that I wrote was published, a time when the inhabitation of the writer by the subject, to use a phrase adopted by the late Elizabeth Young Brewer, the inhabitation might have gone away. I'm not at all sure it has, but the two-year gap might be of interest. The afterlife in these 2 years of a biography is a strange and rather salutary experience. Letters arrive and emails, wondering volubly why a certain image has been chosen rather than another, offering photographs of the subject much more characteristic than the ones that I'd picked. People on whom the subject has exerted a strong influence come out of the shadows, giving a new perspective. Recently, I've had letters from a dance and movement therapist, a writer on embodiment, and a video film artist from Belgium exploring the relationship between language, time, and truth. And the Californian artist, painter, and musician, Dessy Safin-Girard, who made this collage for Marion Milner, has written at some length about the magical conversations she had over the years with Marion Milner, inspired by on not being able to paint. My own patients at One Remove have made new insights, new projects, new ideas, in a sense under the sign of Milner. The biography has become a kind of transitional object for some after the ending of analytic therapy with me. Intriguingly, a person who's never ever thrown anything away, and the resulting installation in Norway, comes forward at a conference, again drawing attention to some Milner ideas. A young international students come and ask for leads in their trail of an inscrutable figure. The subject of the biography does not, in short, die with the end of the book, but is a continuing companion. This can be a mixed blessing, this continuing habitation, and I'd really like to know what Frances has to say about that, if she does. Robert Louis Stevenson wrote, thinking about biography, "Biography is not really so finished as a quite rotten novel. It always has and always must have the incurable illogicalities of life about it." I've written before, and I don't want to repeat this, about the experience of writing about Marion Milner, of trying to find her, having the companionship for many years of a great British analyst, a writer, a poet, a painter, a polymath who, for all her talents and very many friends, was intensely private and someone who wished to remain illegible. The experience of researching for the biography was very much one of being given ring-fenced set pieces, one after the other, and often not much more. Not entirely the case, but that was the general case. She did not wish to be legible. She had to struggle, she said, to be herself in her Edwardian family. Now, there's an image of an angry dragon, which I might show you at the end, but I'm not sure if we've got time for those. There's a certain amount of rage embedded in her struggle. She shares, to some extent, a well-born background of her time with another of today's subjects, Joan Rivière, also a great love of clothes. There's a lot in her first autobiography, A Life of One's Own, about her wish for red shoes, which would solve an awful lot of her day's angst. She had wonderful clothes, a collection of very many scarves and hats, and she minded very much about that kind of style. Lovely clothes. She was, to make another link, she was present at Strachey's wartime seminars in London early in her analytic career, and she describes working with her first patient, a boy who couldn't practice his violin. Strachey had remarked in a seminar that Milner had said nothing about the transference at all in presenting this boy. Her supervisor, who was Ella Sharp at that time, hadn't covered this. However, first, focus on the title of today's event, Unnatural Bedfellows. Are they? Is there an essential disjunction between biography and psychoanalysis? Dee has talked a lot about this. On one level, the pair have significant compatibilities. The importance of the unconscious, for one, the need to address the inner life, and so on. The use of transference to the subject. I certainly transferred a lot of stuff onto Marion Milner, needing a writing companion, someone who could guide me through processes, my own and my students, patients, processes of creative block, writing block, that kind of thing. Certainly reading in later life, I'd read it when I was in my 20s, but later on in my 50s and 60s, rereading on not being able to paint, my experience was more like a patient being taken through the creative process. So that's perhaps a link there. They are, however, psychoanalysis and biography, a couple, as you'll know, with a checkered history. Jones wrote a book he knew Freud wouldn't have liked. In the preface to Volume 1, quote, "It is not a book that would have met with Freud's own approval." And Jones, I understand, had to be lawyered out of denouncing rival biographers and was told Jung could depart, in quotes, in print, but must in no wise defect or betray. Many issues surround the betrothal letters, or did, of Freud and Martha, which Anna Freud protected and Martha Freud wished to burn. Linda Hopkins' book on Hahn bears witness to last-minute retractions. I've been told about similar matters with various books on Winnicott. And in my work for this presentation, I find almost no colleagues who can, even partly unconditionally, find a biography of a psychoanalyst that they've actually liked. This was a straw poll, but I tried quite hard, and I hope today's audience may disagree. It'd be really nice if you did. Okay, The analyst shares a private inner journey, helps to reveal those unconscious patterns and forces by which, to quote Milner, forces by which we are lived. She, the analyst, is bound by confidentiality and professional constraints. She is outside the realm of what Rachel Bowlby has called delicious gossip. I'm not so sure about that. I'd quite like some delicious gossip, actually, but don't always get it when you might like it. The patient's free associations cannot be forced. The analyst may yearn to know, for example, about the madnesses of the patient's forebears, crazy ghosts lurking in the family tree, but she is not the driver of her own curiosity. She must wait and see, with free-floating attention, fantasies held in abeyance, what the patient brings. The psychoanalyst is to some degree bound to an unsatisfied curiosity. We prize curiosity in our patients, usually, as we do in our children. But at this point, there's a caveat. Information cannot be forced from a patient. I was reminded by one of my own patients only this week that to ask a question at the wrong moment was a deal-breaker, an unwelcome echo, or in this person's case, anemic trace of a very, very intrusive mother. Similarly, information cannot be retrieved from the biographic subject, particularly in the case of a deceased subject. Just as, at the end of the treatment, the analyst is most likely never to know the rest of the story, so, with the biographer, control lies with the patient. And here there is similarity between analyst and biographer. The driver in psychoanalysis is the patient and the patient's flow, or not, of free associative material, dreams, daydreams, reverie. The controller in biography is the subject, not the writer. And I think, or suggest, this perhaps accounts for the trend for biography that morphs into autobiography, parallel lives in one volume. The most recent one that I've been struck by is the homage to George Eliot, Rebecca Mead's The Road to Middlemarch, which, as you'll know probably, is a hybrid of literary biography, deep reading and personal memoir. And dual narratives of this kind, I think, have been strikingly common since about the 1980s, and maybe before. The difficulties of writing a biography of the psychoanalyst are perhaps clear enough. For example, and crucially, how to negotiate the situation of patients who are still living, supervisees who are still practicing or are practicing in the contemporary world, how to satisfy the demands of biography, to find what you can about the person and their world, and for an analyst writer, their inner world, and remain respectful of the need, not just for discretion, but confidentiality. How to maintain the person's reputation and at the same time be truthful to those less than ideal aspects of the subject's personality. Holmes, the biographer, Richard Holmes, interestingly, I think, comments as follows on the fault line running down between the notion of biography as a kind of fictional retelling and against the notion that the biographer, the historian, must tell the truth, be committed to the truth, to the facts, to the research. I think that's quite an interesting fault line. There are questions... How to maintain the person's reputation. There are questions as to the skill of some of today's subjects as mothers that could open a heated debate about the subject's character. Milner's last and posthumously published autobiography, Bothered by Alligators, reveals a somewhat reluctant mother struggling in an interesting but very difficult and tortured marriage. And this is tricky territory if the child of the analyst subject is living and interesting and involved. Part of the afterlife of the biological project with Milner is the question of whether or not Bothered by Alligators should have been published. As I say, in Milner's case, it reveals less than ideal aspects of herself. She leaves her child to go to Spain when he was about 2 years old, and she suffers fearful reactions on her return. She then spends very many years bearing her guilt for other actions of absence. The book is an honest reassessment and courageous analysis by someone who was nearly 90 when she assembled it and wrote it, and self-analysis of her actions, a deeply felt act of reparation, as well as an account of intense mental pain. Each biographer must, of course, find their own way with what they do and do not include. I used a test I'd employed with my own rather over-colourful family. In the case of very potentially inflammatory documents, I asked myself, I wonder how the grandchildren would feel about reading this. How would I feel about grandchildren reading it? I haven't got any, but that's not the point. What is being passed on to the next generation? If the answer was a definite no, I didn't include it. Neither, however, did I destroy it. It wasn't mine to destroy, I felt. Milner didn't want to be found. We could say her, with her, to take up a Winnicottian phrase, that it was a great pleasure to be hidden. Very crucially, nor did her well-known patient Susan, the nominated subject of Hands of the Living God. At this point, the biographer of an analyst has to make a decision to continue to search for a patient or to cease searching. I stopped searching, and I still don't know whether Susan still lives or any details like that at all. I've assumed and respected that she didn't wish to be found. I put out various advertisements and feelers, you can imagine, that could have been responded to were she around. So she is, in a sense, unincluded, or more accurately, her contemporary voice is unspoken. Of course, she's very much included in terms of her central role as Anne Lysand in the book itself, and the meticulous account of her 20-year-long treatment which Milner gives us. This brings me to the issue of how the biographer may need to negotiate with her subject's autobiographies. Marion wrote four. The first of what Hugh Horton has called Experiments in Autobiography, A Life of One's Own, is a very inward book. It's an inner life, a quest, quote, into the hinterlands of my own mind. And this leads to an important characteristic of Milner's autobiographical writings. In her third book, written in her 80s and published in 1987, Eternity's Sunrise, she writes that the reader may be surprised to find so few beads. Beads is her word for those vital moments of unconscious power. It's her version of Joyce's epiphanies or Woolf's moments of being. She says that the reader's going to be surprised that so few beads have people in them. Why so few, not more moments with people in my beads? Of course there have been many everyday joys with people that I could have recorded, but that doesn't seem to be the point in what something in me is trying to get at. Also, I'd have had to be a novelist or a poet even to begin to describe properly the moments with people. It's more a question of finding how contacting one's body's innerness affects one's relations to people outside. It certainly does, just as there is more vastness of objects outside when I attend to breathing inside. There are in Eternity Sunrise places and atmospheres and animals and birds and landscapes and artifacts, but very few people, and those there are of a generic type, a young girl, a shepherd, that kind of thing. In A Life of One's Own, the first autobiography, Milner discovers psychoanalysis. She's also her own observer, her own analyst. As Rachel Bowlby has observed, Milner splits herself into two personae, the one who lives the experiences and who writes them down, and the one who seeks to understand and integrate the thoughts of these two stages. Milner learns, or teaches herself, to become an observer of herself and thereby to change the self who is observed. I'm aware of the time. My next brief section, which I'll hurry up about, was about biographic care. I've had occasion to ask myself, what might we mean by biographic care? When we think about this, we're fortunate that in Milner's Hands of the Living God, an extended case history, a kind of life writing, we can see her care as an analyst writer. She provides provision for her patient Susan when needed, cover over the long vacations, contact by letter during holidays and absences, and in the tradition of Winnicott, with whom she was very close friends, as well as sometime Ann and Sand, benign management of her very ill and stressed patient. Susan came to Milner following a treatment by ECT, a devastating failure of care. Ironically, this treatment left Susan with, quote, something missing that she didn't have before. And she says she doesn't care anymore. Nothing makes any difference. But also that she has no willpower, and she did before. The care itself is damaging. Can a biographer's care be damaging? The short answer is yes. The potential for damage that can be caused by idealization, I think, is particularly acute. Tim Parks is someone who's questioned in a New York piece why it is that literary biographers feel the need to depict their subjects as especially admirable beings. There's special pleading everywhere. For example, Dickens's treatment of his wife, Lawrence's at best cavalier treatment of Frieda, and I'm sure we can think of others, but those will do for the moment. So, I'm going to miss out the next bit, which is about empathy. So, does a biographer have a duty of care to the subject? A duty to let suffering speak? I think yes, again, in the case of a patient like Susan, who'd been the victim of a coercive system. And Milner lets her own suffering speak in Bothered by Alligators. Brett Carr has this to say. In spite of the growth of psychoanalytical historiography, I cannot recall a single instance in which an author stopped to think about the possible effect of revealing intimate personal information on the analysands of particular subjects, of the particular subject. I agree with him here that this should be a concern for those who engage in the writing or the history or life writings of psychoanalysis. And I'd end by invoking Barbara Taylor, who I last heard in this room, or along the passage in this room, author of Asylum, writing about how the demise of case history in our hurried and over outcome-driven times is no longer de rigueur. As Taylor says, without history, people disappear. Perhaps we have a responsibility, psychoanalyst and biographer alike, to withstand this trend.
I think there's a great deal to talk about, isn't there? The same problem here. And I think one of the things that perhaps just put into place at the very start is the fact that, of course, the two occupations are different, a biographer and a psychoanalyst. And we heard how if you ask the wrong question or the too penetrating question at the wrong moment, it can be deadly and kill the process of what's going on the part of the analyst. So, to some extent, on the part of the analyst, and we know that psychoanalysis is a very good thing because it helped lock down certain assumptions and received opinion about human behaviour, and therefore delayed, pushes back judgment and introduced the possibility of much greater tolerance in our society. But the facility of the analyst that is there, of course, there's something else going on as well, but in the biographer, there's obviously something slightly different. The position is slightly different, is what I'm trying to say. And yet, I think both have, to some extent, have a capacity to be blotting paper, to have to absorb, and so on. So there's similarity and differences within their position. May I turn first to Marion and say that I was very intrigued by the letter you mentioned from Ernest Jones to Freud saying of your character, that she was so, he discovered his casework with her being a complete failure because she was, her emotions were so, she was so emotional and such an emotional creature. And I wondered how long that you took to discover that and and whether that is really a reason for analysis being difficult.
I'm not sure whether to reply as a biographer or as a psychiatrist. as her biographer, I wish she'd committed more of her emotions. Actually, she committed a lot of her emotions to paper in these letters to him.
which I have to say are the most boring thing on earth, and not at all like other things that she wrote. So as a biographer, it wasn't terribly well placed emotion. I think it was the analysis did go terribly wrong, actually, and because I mean, he completely eroded the boundaries between them, and then he sort of was somehow surprised that she thought he was seducing her, really.
But I mean, this is the woman who went on, as you said, to have a very rigorous approach to analysis.
Yeah.
So she obviously acquired the skills, the training, though she only had 6 months with Freud.
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons she was so keen on a rigorous approach is she had an unrigorous approach. it hasn't helped her, really. Although Freud was not noted for his rigor either. He was an exchange present with patients and so on. I think it was Wolfman, people might correct me, that he actually supported financially. But I think that as an analyst, he certainly had the patient's needs far more in mind than Jones did.
And can I just pick up on a tiny thing which is just a desperate interest to myself? When he said that she was his favourite translator, what exactly and how much work was he referring to in that instance, and why do you think he said that?
He said it to her in a number of letters, which wasn't space to quote, that he would prefer her to do certain translations more than anything else. So that it's quite unequivocal. Maybe he said the same to the straight chief, but actually I think he got rather fed up with the straight chiefs because they were so slow.
Well, the other thing, I mean, please let anybody in the audience correct me if this is wrong, but the criticism of James Strachey's translations is that he thought that his need was to create a scientific basis for psychoanalysis. And so the kind of sort of references through the choice of words to literature or to mythology and all these other resonances were somewhat dulled in James Strachey's tone.
Well,
so was she doing something very different?
Yes, she was actually. I really wish my memory was better, but there's a very interesting paper by someone who I think is called Nina Backman, who is, I think, German, who is making comparisons between the Strachey translations and Genevieve's translations. And she used much more sort of ordinary language, but also, so that she actually produced something, because I think Freud's German was quite poetic. So what she produced is something much more like Freud, and sentence structure and the use of sort of quite imaginative words, and there's one word of Freud's, I can't remember it because I don't speak German, where James Strachey writes it as a sort of like a disagreement or something, and she has a much more sort of fiery word for it, which seems to fit more with the German.
So was he at that time, James Strachey started at the time, was he by implication suggesting a certain sense of the limitations of James Strachey? Or did it not happen in that way?
Well, I'm not sure. In a way, Dee might know more than me about this, but I think that possibly he thought it was going to make it all more scientific. Freud used words like the it, where Strachey would use the it. But I think possibly his personality was quite. It's very interesting because we were talking about the Bloomsbury Freud thing, which is a selection of letters between James and Alex Strachey when she was having a second analysis with Abraham. It's very interesting. You can see with both of them there's a real problem. I don't know if you agree with me, Dee. I think I'll stop talking after this and you can take over. I feel that they're both very, very inhibited people who can express themselves far more freely in letters.
The Strachey's.
Yes.
I think that's probably true. Yeah, I think he's much, much more of his garden. It's a very complicated story. The Strait is first translated in 1921, but really, there's a marvellous paper by Ricardo Steiner. I don't know if any of you know Ricardo Steiner's work, where he sort of proves that the whole thing was a sort of master plan of Jones. Jones was determined to get control of all translation of Freud into English language. And Jones really, to an extent, lent on Freud to take both Joan Rivière, John Rickman, and Jane Strachey into analysis, partly with the hope of winning them over for translation. So there actually was an active project to recruit them.
who says that Jones lent on Freud to take Joan Rivière? I don't think that's the case.
No, I think he lent on them to take the Strachey's.
Yeah, possibly, but... That because she wrote to Freud herself, and I don't think Jones is right. Well, I mean, as I indicated, I think
did Jones not write to Freud in order to get her to take more? Because what happens with Strachey is Strachey speaks to Jones, Strachey approaches Freud directly, but Jones also writes sort of just a bit after Strachey's made his approach to Freud, and Jones says that this man might help us in translation. So it's very clear in Strachey's case.
I think it's very interesting because a lot of people say, oh, Jones sent Rivière to Freud. Hmm. It's become one, I mean, I'm certainly much more aware since I've been doing this project, how much things get enshrined and one book says it and another book says it. Yeah. Whereas, as far as I can see, Joan of her own accord wrote to Freud and I think she'd been encouraged by doing this translation. And in fact, Jones wasn't at all keen.
So she did the translation in England first?
Yes.
Right.
And Jones wasn't at all keen at this point.
Who did she do the translation for in terms of publishing?
The International Journal was really an English publication, although it was meant to, you know, be for lots of countries. I think she really didn't look good. There was a problem with A.A. Brill's translations. That Freud had been rather indifferent about who translated his work. And then this chap A.A. Brill translated it, and it was so awful that an American neurologist called Putnam wrote to Freud saying, do you realize how it's all being mangled? And, then I think everyone got more interested in finding better translators.
But the other thing one has to say about James Strachey, surely, is that he found in Leonard Woolf someone who was prepared not just to cherry pick what bits of Freud he wanted, but to do the whole shoot.
Yes, that was an amazing.
And there weren't called to be many other publishers at that time when Samuel Hazard was so young. Who might be prepared to do that?
Strachey had a different approach. He had this strange thing because he never seems to have taken any interest in science at all in his life, but he had some sort of backwash towards science. His father was a distinguished scientist, and then he did classics to start with at Cambridge and slept through that, and then moral science. But yeah, he's something about him. He had that idea of how a proper text should be. And of course, I suppose you have to look at the standard edition perhaps as a tendency to distance Freud from anything Germanic as well. But the sad fact is that Ernest Jones really set up all those ghastly terms like the id. There was a glossary committee with Joan Rivière and Strachey, but Jones just sort of rides roughshod over everybody and did what he wanted, and his choices were often quite peculiar. And I think perhaps Joan Rivière was better at sticking two fingers up to Jones than James Strachey. My theory about the Strachey's is, because you know they were husband and wife teams, that they survived Jones longer than other people. Because actually they laughed about him behind their back, they could get together and giggle, you know, so they had an outlet in frustration.
Yes, there's a very interesting fact, if I could mention, kind of, that when Freud came here, Leonard and Virginia Woolf came to see him, and one of the things that Leonard wanted to ask was that the title Moses and Monotheism wouldn't help the book sell, because they hadn't got Monotheism was in the late 30s and so on. And Freud was desperately upset that they should think of... he wanted just to title Moses, I think. And it seems a terrible dumbing down on the part of Leonard Woolf. Freud even wrote to his publisher in America, didn't he, to say, please do not shorten the title.
Well, either dumbing down or kind of quite clever salesmanship. I mean, monotheism was a difficult word.
Yeah. You said at one point in your talk that all biographers were long to set their patients
on the couch.
Yes, and indeed, somebody did have access when they read a biography of Anne Sexton, the poet.
Mm-hmm. It's been highly controversial.
Yes. Now, did she have access to the tape recordings or
yes, notes? She had. It was also a book of the patient allowed them to have access to the recordings. And I mean, the press has been full of, the psychiatrist press has been full of the ethics.
Was the psychoanalyst alive when they got this access to this material?
I think he was. So Marilyn Monroe's analyst came utterly disgracefully as well as confidentiality. Mm. There's a huge amount of this going on.
Yes. Well, the issue of confidentiality is, I think, a big one and an important one, particularly some of the questions, Emma, that you asked. I wonder if you could revert to that more immediately now, because you seem to suggest that you thought there was a moment when you wanted to step back, and obviously you've stepped back from chasing Susan.
Yes, Susan.
I wondered if with that you thought that there was a decorum or a delicacy or a diplomacy that means that you had to constrain yourself, cut off your researchers and respect the right to privacy. You quoted that wonderful remark by Mary Milner, it's a great pleasure to be hidden.
Yes, that's what he called it.
Sorry.
A joy to be hidden, but a disaster not to be found.
The trouble is we live in a world today where people want things to be accountable, and they don't want to have a cover-up in any area. If you're writing about someone, public figure out there, they want to feel and have trust in the biographer that they're willing to present what's normal with it, and to really be fair to the person to give an overall picture and not choose that one section of their life should be totally omitted. Now, if you have other feelings about the complications of the situations around that desire, so would you suggest that's...
Do you want me to say something about the complications?
Yes, that might be helpful to suggest how it arises.
In the search for Susan, I went as far as I felt I was able to go. Advertisements, asking archivists if they would forward a letter, that kind of thing.
So they knew where she was.
Asking people where I believed she'd worked at some point, whether a letter would be forwarded. And I put various advertisements, but a lot of people did answer. Well, I thought it was a lot for a biographer. A lot of people answered. There was one person that I couldn't, with my hand on my heart, say was definitely not Susan, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't.
You mean they answered as if they were her?
They turned up. People turned up and answered. Anyway, after all this, I decided that she was not to be found and I needed to stop. So I stopped. That's one answer. Another bit of the answer. In the course of the research, there were some letters that I read. I was obliged to read. They were in an archive, that I decided would be very, very hurtful to people who were still alive. Would radically change their attitude to other people and to their lives. And I decided not to quote from them because people were still alive. Now that some of those people are still dead, perhaps somebody else will come along and write a different book. I might write an essay about that bit of the afterlife of the biography. I'm not sure that I will, but I might.
Well, I think that's actually voiced a fairly widely shared recognition that although you have this desire for fullness and for balance, obviously, of the parts, but for an authentic nothing held back in terms of the overall picture, I'm not saying that you need to be prurient in depth about certain things, but I'm saying that if you want the shape of a person of their whole life, if there's something that's been blocked out, it may distort it in some way. But that there is a need to respect the right to privacy of the people who are still living.
Another variable here. One or two people who I interviewed who were very, very helpful to me interviewed me and gave me very rich and deep material about my subject on condition that I did nothing that would hurt a couple of people who were still alive.
to effectively silence you about what they
didn't silence me about very much.
You can say quite a bit without actually.
You can say quite a bit without the data.
Now, the other thing, next thing I want to point out is the fact that in analysis, there's often this attention to seemingly irrelevant facts, which the analyst then picks up and travels around and proves that these are a terrible reflection of something or other. Is this so?
I think perhaps I ought to say that I'm not, as a writer, as a biographer, I'm not interested in psychoanalyzing my subject.
Right.
I'm interested in following her journey of discovery of psychoanalysis and her companionship of working with, for instance, creative blocks being alongside my subject.
Right.
I'm not interested in psychoanalyzing
it. You didn't
or even the other biographers have written. I'm not interested.
So you didn't pick up on any detail and find it either symbolic or meaningful in a psychoanalytical way. You deliberately decided not to follow.
No, I just didn't approach it in that way.
Right.
I took her as a companion and let her inhabit me, to use Jan Brühl's phrase, and went along with it that way.
Well, what should the biographer do if he or she is aware of things like displacement and other activities of the mind that psychoanalysis has brought to our attention, which suggests a much less straightforward form of analysis of human behaviour than might have been used in the past?
I think modern, well, judging by published biographies, they don't want to be suppressed.
Mm.
People go wild with analysis, really. Maybe they're all being terribly restrained, but surely there must be a difference between a biography of a person who's died, like Queen Victoria, even though I know she's got descendants, but they must be used to all sorts of rubbish, and someone who's currently alive, because there seems a lot more biography these days of, you know, sporting heroes or pop stars and so on. And presumably that must be a very difficult area.
Well, certainly some biographers do make use of psychoanalytic theory to try and analyse right about the subject. And you actually rather criticised that, didn't you?
Yes.
Well,
I don't know if I was criticising that. I think the thing to do is to do it with some sort of moderation. Perhaps one should write what one thinks and leave it in a drawer for a couple of weeks and rub out some of the, you know, the definitive psychoanalytic statements and perhaps use more ordinary language. But I don't think one could shy away from it. I mean, certainly for me, I'm just fascinated by what can I retrieve of James Strachey's analysis with Freud. So I've been thinking about that a lot. I'm trying to, I think is worthwhile. I think it's because he was, quite a convinced analyst and a Freudian, and he had some important training patients. So I think it is relevant to work out perhaps what he and Freud were dealing with, what they were working on. I think the thing is to perhaps to write, you know, this is just a classic writing exercise, isn't it? To write what you think and then leave it for a while and then slightly tone it down and think about what you can and can't prove. I mean, with Strachey, I've got a great deal of evidence. He was the man in love with Rookie, wrote him something like 180 letters. So I don't have to sort of make any case for the fact that in his adolescence and early adulthood, he was gay. I think it's fair enough to do a
comparison. Could I ask you all three generally, I mean, what difference has the discovery of this approach to thinking about the human mind and how we operate as human beings has made more generally to the perception of lives as well as biography?
I think you have to remember that Freud said he wasn't saying anything new, that people did know, that people... I remember once my first analyst saying to me that he thought when I was 3 or 4 I'd worked out my parents had an unconscious. I mean, of course, I didn't have a word for it. I did know that the things that people said and what they did were always the same thing. In a way, it's given a language, actually, more to, some precision. But I think it's a very big difference, actually, between biography and psychoanalysis.
You know, I mean, I just think of my activities with a patient and my activities with Joan Rivière, even though she uses herself as the patient and, in her best papers.
What use would you make of the fact that she was also a dressmaker, which one of the audience said came to her as a great surprise that this woman,
yeah,
so good in all ways, was prepared to be engaging with this activity?
Yeah. Well, I think it's very sort of interesting. I think, you know, as I said, you know, her mother's always presented as the bad guy, and she had quite a tense, distant relationship with her. But her mother was someone who's terribly interested in appearance. You know, I mean, I think what, you know, psychoanalysis would tell me, as it were, is that, you know, people aren't always, cut and dried, as you think. I think that she was very influenced by her mother in some ways, particularly in matters of appearance and love of art, and I think probably her dislike of children came through her mother's. I mean, her mother was one of 12, so you can see she wasn't absolutely wild about babies. I think it came, you know, you can see that, you know, the whole family line completely came to an end with that family, because Joan's sister, she had a brother and a sister, and we don't really know, I don't think, what happened to her brother. They sort of packed them off to the colonies, because Joan really had the brains in that group of children. And her sister did marry, but never had children. And Joan's daughter didn't marry or have children.
So what do we do with these, what you call the incurable illogicalities of life? And as a biographer, Kate Cooper
respond to them with normal human unhappiness.
It's that famous remark by Freud that he isn't. Can you repeat it for us?
I'm not doing quotations to say next.
They're slipping. You didn't mention that when Michael Holroyd wrote his life of Living Strangely, it was just before the, was it the Wolf and the...
The Wolf and the Lion, I think, is about 57, but it was then the government changed the law, I think, about 67, so it was just on the cusp of implementing the recommendations, yeah.
So his first volume of Living Strangely came out in 66?
Yes.
And the second one is 68.
So the law would change, yeah.
Mm. And there was quite a lot of anxiety within very sort of... famously sort of, you know... broad-minded Bloomsbury about whether or not this book should be allowed to be published.
Yes, Garnet was particularly against it, wasn't he? I mean, poor Duncan Grant did his best and put up with it. And there was a great deal of anxiety because exposing their past lives. But James Strachey had, and he's a very quiet man and always very reserved. He had this sort of undercurrent of sort of messianic desire to change the society. I mean, he really was quite left-wing, and he definitely thought, this is what poor Michael Holroyd was labouring against. I'm sure we've had a long conversation with him, that Dutton would have had a life as a great sort of homosexual campaigner had he lived. And this was one of the tensions within the biography, because Michael Holroyd wasn't writing it James Strachey's way, but, you know, to give Strachey credit, he tolerated that. Yeah, it was, and apparently it was very influential with a lot of people, and of course it had its revival in the 80s when they made the film Carrington, is all based on Michael Holroyd's work, Living Strachey's life and James Strachey's letters. It was worrying, but I think it was worthwhile. But yes, it really upset them, and James Strachey was very off Bloomsbury towards the end of his life, because he was fighting battles on several fronts, and they were trying to block the biography. But Leonard couldn't talk to Michael Holroyd, would he?
I think
he wouldn't.
But I mean, I'm very glad you're writing your book, because I think that James Strachey has been rather left out of the picture, and it is so hugely important what he achieved.
I mean, one of his weaknesses, I'd say, he did love gossip. You know, he writes to Lytton from Vienna saying, well, it was gossip. And of course, what's notorious is the fact that they put all these slighting comments about Winnicott and going to Freud. But then he had he thought the truth, I think he perhaps had a simple idea that truth might set people free, and of course, you know, in the case of badly damaged and Alessandro, you find that their analysis is very good. That isn't true, but I think Strachey thought that big, tough, upper middle class people like Bloomsbury could just, you know, take it on the chin, and that they should be more honest about.
Yeah.
of sexuality.
But I think when Duncan Grant got into the second volume of Michael Moore, he was simply appalled by
Duncan Grant was very, very generous. But there was also, I should tell you something briefly, the situation, which is a great insight into his character, I've got to admit it. He was in competition with Geoffrey Cain's, Maynard Cain's brother over both Rupert Brooke letters and the Lytton Strachey Maynard Cain's correspondence, which is great. And you know, one owned one half and one owned the other. The thing is that the receiver owns the letter, don't they? But the copy, you know, the literary sector wants the copyright, so they were competing. And Cain says this stuff must never appear, you know, in 100 years. And James Strachey got a sneaky microfilm, which I thought was great. So no way that I guess that Cain had Lytton's half, but Strachey had the copyright too.
There was a wonderful evening here actually when I think Francis Partridge was brought, the elderly member of the Bloomsbury
The entry of the index.
Yes. Almost the only woman in Britain who read the whole way through the whole of Troy and all the end of the index. And she was asked to come and talk about her relationships with Freud. And there's a huge photograph with the Strachey's, and there's a huge photograph of Freud on the wall behind the screen. And I think Barbara Strachey was here too, anyway, Francis gave a wonderful description of James and Alex Strachey sitting in their garden as they lived. And inside those things you put your suit in when you travel. Slightly windy, they managed to zip through.
Let me see if I can find that. There you are, you can put another document. Yeah,
what psychoanalyst did that? And could you just say a little bit more about Marianne Milner? Because I felt at the end that you did have this sense of wanting to be rather discreet about her and not push her too far to discover things perhaps about her that it might have given her.
She was a very discreet person.
Yeah.
What do you want to know about her?
I don't know that I can answer.
Can I ask a question? I'm sorry, this is perhaps cutting across you, Francis, but I wondered with Susan whether Susan is Marianne Milner.
Susan was Marianne Milner.
Yeah. Well, I'm only asking that because I certainly feel, reading some of Winnicott's case studies, that he's made them up.
I think this is getting more and more dangerous.
I was 99% no.
I think at this point I'm going to have to show those questions. Please, to someone who is what I'm sure in your conversations over our refreshment break, that there's lots of interesting things said. So do please bring some of them forward. Yes.
I just had a thought from that last little bit of conversation there as to the extent to which biographers might take on the nature of their subject, and that Milner's reticence, actually Emma is beginning to take on.
Yes. I'm quite like her in quite a lot of ways, and she does and did inhabit me.
Did you know?
No.
She was around a Primrose Hill. She used to wear extraordinary socks.
Yes.
No, I did not know. I was living and working in Hong Kong for most of the time when I must have.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Any more?
Yes, okay.
I suppose one of the sort of words that ended up sort of sticking in my mind, mainly from your introduction, is to do with narrative.
Yes.
And I'm particularly keen to sort of think, because, I mean, actually, we're sort of all familiar with the idea that biographies, perhaps you're expecting some kind of narrative, but then in the psychoanalytic context, we're talking about free association, which actually in itself is actually kind of anti-narrative. Mm. So if you're then going to approach the subject of writing about a psychoanalyst, and you can't free associate your way through a biography, how do you handle this issue?
The aims are different, aren't they, Savannah? Yes, a very interesting difference.
And one of the things I ran out of time to say was that, you know, when I think the comparison is very false when you're comparing psychoanalytic therapy with biography writing is the fact that the analyst and the analyst and or patient are in the room sort of agreeing this narrative, and they both know that some of it perhaps is factually inaccurate, but they're sort of working on something together. And Freud makes this really, to me, always rather puzzling distinction between historical truth and material truth. This is the material truth is less important than the historical truth. But of course, for a biographer, you know, you want to get your material truth right. You want to have a narrative that's progressing in the same way. And you know, the sort of, I don't know what you call it, it's not really history taking, but the sort of reconstruction or construction of a life that you do in psychoanalysis is so different in that way, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
I wonder a bit whether there is a sort of reconcilable thing, because I got a collection of bits and pieces, as it were, which is published about Leslie Blanche, who is a biographer who wrote about one of the books is called The Wilder Shores of Love, so you get this sort of message. And she writes this as a sort of preface to this collection of papers, that in biography you don't make things up, but you can interpret. Mm. And she says, but that doesn't stop you using your imagination. And in fact, I have to confess that little bits of Joan Rivière I've imagined, because I think I feel a bit like Emma, really. I feel slightly identified with her, that I've always been absolutely hopeless at dressmaking, so not in that area, but as personality, perhaps, I feel a bit identified. And so there are bits, though not a lot, that I've made up.
You're not alone in this, in that a very respectable or non-fiction writer called Gillian Tyndall, who's from North London, has wrote a book on the 17th century printmaker who did those wonderful views of London. Mm. And because there's very few papers and she wanted to bring him, give you a sense of vitality of him, she found it necessary to invent conversations between him and his son or wife, thus to sort of fill in what were completely silent gaps. Mm-hmm. So these are difficult, I think, because the biography is an artist or a novelist under oath. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is a tremendous sort of need to be absolutely as correct as you can be, not only to the actual facts, but to the tone of voice, to the when hyperbole is being used, when someone's just teasing. A lot of American academics take Virginia Woolf deadly seriously, and I mean she's being completely sort of self-mocking, teasing of others and everything, and they can't sometimes hear it. So there's a tremendous need, I think, to respect the otherness of your subject and to try and catch as accurately as possible through the material you have to hand something about their way of life and their character and their conversations and so on. But of course, any biographer, perhaps like any analyst, has also faced with gaps, illusions, and silences. There are the destroyed letters with a particular person who may not have been important for life, but they seem to occur frequently in other people's references and so on. So you're always going to produce something that is incomplete, is fragmented, is inadequate to the real person. You're never going to arrive at the, official designated final life. Mm-hmm. And of course, as time goes on, the questions change. Further biographers might come to your subject and look at this person from a different point of view, with a much sharper sense of feminist issues or whatever. And then the thing begins to change and new emphases come to the fore. So it should to some extent be open-ended to allow for this sort of recognition that you haven't got the full answers and so on. I remember when I finished my Vanessa Bell biography that one critic said, but she doesn't say how good an artist she was. And there's an awful sort of tendency sometimes for people want you to say, you know, came first in the race, second runners, also rounds. And, you know, those things change, like also according to the way people, the lenses that people put over artists and writers and so on, and discover new meanings or relevance and so on. So perhaps there's a deliberate need to recognise these, the importance of not knowing and silences. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Can I ask you something? What do you make of this psychoanalytic text? It almost sort of saved Virginia Woolf from beyond the grave. You must have had to sort of read a great deal about what was wrong with her and what should or could have been done.
Only in regard to her mental illness.
It's a subject that psychoanalysts can't seem to stay away from, but they often say quite strange things, I find.
Yes, there's been a lot of interest in her doctors and the treatment that she was given. There was very little understanding of what to do at that time. Yes. Going around, people try to analyse what exactly was the problem, and come up with bipolar disorder and so on, or schizophrenia. I remember going around with, when the Virginia Woolf exhibition was on in the National Portrait Gallery, someone called Dame Carol Black. And she read in the one of the finals of Farewell, Suicide Letters, as I horribly called, that Virginia Woolf says, "I have been hearing voices again." And she said, "Oh, well, that must mean, you know, that perhaps schizophrenic." Now, if she was schizophrenic, it was remarkable that she had such two really complete breakdowns and did go mad, and yet recovered enough to have this enormously sane, constructive, and creative life, produced all those words, all those novels, two non-fiction things, two books, and acres of letters, acres of essays. I mean, what a formidable, working, productive life. And have such severe mental illness.
Yes.
It is quite formidable. So I think you have to withhold the strength as to what that cause of that mental illness was, actually, because it's such a complex and difficult thing to really assess.
Yes, I agree, but you do, because when you're sort of looking at psychoanalytic contributions on Pinterest, that you do get Chanel, and I think there's Rose, and virtually everyone does the same. Why didn't you? Virginia Woolf's brother was a psychoanalyst, and she used strictures and what have you. You know, why didn't they treat her? But, you know, so I agree with you, really, that it's by any skill, what if anybody could have helped her?
There's a wonderful moment when she comes to this house with Leonard to see Freud, and obviously they sit downstairs in his salon because she talks about it, and she says she felt she ought to have been on the couch. and they talk a bit about it, and of course he had his throat problems, so the talking was quite difficult. But afterwards she is gulping down Freud, not I think to understand her own stuff so much, but to sharpen herself, to make her, to keep her more alive and aware of things. She felt it extremely necessary to read what having done so much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry. Yes.
I was interested what you said about the sort of the sense of a biography being an unfinished project. At the end of the sort of the first part of this, I thought, well, actually being a psychoanalyst makes it much more difficult for you to write a biography. And what I saw in front of me were the two situations in the consulting room, where on the one hand, the analyst is having a conversation with the patient, and on the other hand, you've got behind you a sort of framework of theory. And I wondered if you could say a bit about whether you feel that it's being an analyst makes it easier to deal with the unfinished project and let's say the sort of the sometimes kind of creative things that happen that where you can't exactly pin things down in a biography, these gaps which actually make it interesting, or whether your theoretical framework is actually making it more difficult for you to write a biography.
Have we got any firm Freudians here? I don't think we have.
We've got a firm Kleinian
here. Kleinian has quite a severe, quite a sort of restrictive sort of interpretation of what should happen at each stage. I mean, I haven't
read very much. She had a very flexible idea about it. She said that we all go backwards and forwards. I mean, it was Freud who had this, you know, though I don't think he seemed to stick with it very much, you know, this scheme of the sexual development. Klein had these two developmental stages that she said we all go backwards and forwards between them. And certainly modern thinking is that development is always backwards and forwards. You know, it's not a reasoning. But Klein was very interested in literature, and as was Joan Rivière in fact. But I think what's really important, I mean, because you can, if you're a psychotherapist or a psychoanalyst, I imagine, read literature and or biography and see things in it. But I think what matters more is that people, when I was younger, used to say, show, don't tell. That I think what's nice to read in a biography is something that shows you. I don't want to be told too much. I can form my own view. I don't mean there shouldn't be any analysis or thought on the part of the biographer, but if you get overloaded with the biographer's thoughts, carefully explaining that the person, you get rather fed, I get rather fed up, really. I want just to sort of let the person come to me, as it were.
I want to answer with my Milner hat on. I don't know how much this will answer, but there were many gaps in our absences. You know, things were lost. It was like Hardy novel. Letters almost went underneath the doormat and weren't found, and that kind of thing, or you missed people in the alleyway. You know, that kind of thing. There was a lot of that sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, missing people, missing things. That's sort of one bit of the answer. I suppose I find writing a writer with all the gaps and absences and all those things was very much helped by reading and living with her on Not Being Able to Paint, with its very, very strong emphasis on creative blocks and on freeing the unconscious to paint in a free way, but also to write in a kind of free-form way. And that was absolutely vital. So that's a Milner type
But I think we've probably now almost, we've just gone a little bit, if you want quickly one,
how's it gone?
Well, I don't know how quick it is, I'll keep it quick.
Yes.
I guess I just wanted to speak to my sense of puzzlement about some of the topics that we're looking at. And the phrase that actually comes to my mind is, it's actually one of Freud's about impossible professions, which of course he originally applied to politics and education as well as psychoanalysis. And I think I'm just sort of toying with the idea that there is something intrinsically impossible about the biographical task. I don't mean in a disrespectful way. I've co-authored a biography, I've studied Phyllis Grosskirk's biography of Klein and the Fugitive of Sunday. I've been very inward with the biographical enterprise. But I think there's scope for thinking that, particularly with this discussion about absent data, silences, the gaps that one is always going to find, the ethical issue about how much one can actually interpret the life of the individual, whether or not one's got the data to do it. I mean, it's a really ethical issue. I keep coming back to some notion of the possible at the most honourable level. You know, not that there wouldn't be biographies, and there are very great biographies. Read, and we've been hearing about very interesting biographies this evening, but that there's something inherently impossible about the task. Because what I just want to share, because it feels so relevant, one of the most brilliant observations that I think Richard Holmes makes, I think it's somewhere in Footstones, where he writes about the writing of the Shelley biography, and he says that he basically wrote it through the night in a state of deep. I think that's very, very interesting as a kind of vignette of the activity of creating biography, that it may require a certain kind of psychic state, but that ultimately it includes loss. Mm-hmm. There's this longing to create the person, but somewhere in it there's terrible loss. Yeah. And of course it's such a brilliant biography, and it's such an interesting observation.
I would intervene. Can I just quickly answer this? I think that very much ties in with this notion of being inhabited.
Yes.
I think he very much, in the dark hours of the night, was inhabited by the presence of spirit, his own brilliant sense of
it. It wasn't only in the dark hours of the night, because when he went up to go through his checks, he was put 17. I think on that point, thank you very much indeed, because I think it is important to say that the no biographer, perhaps no psychoanalyst, could do the final equation on any character, or even on Virginia Woolf finds that we do not know our own souls, let alone the souls of others, in that sense of the unknowability of the human, the aspects of the human nature. Well, thank you very much. I just want to bring it to an end this evening, and perhaps to say that maybe one of the great things that psychoanalysis has given to biography writing is that encouragement to walk around things, to look at situations, problems from many perspectives, and to realise that things can be moved round by doing that activity. And maybe biography has given to analysis a sense that there's, you know, I don't know what's quite given to it, but anyway, something I do. Thank you all for coming. You've been a fantastic audience. Thank you for a wonderful evening. Can we thank our speakers?